So this is our second talk on Person in the Hut. And this talk is going to, our focus for this talk is going to be a little bit unusual. It's not a Zen text. It's not even really a religious text, and although we'll see it does touch on religious elements. It is perhaps, we may say, a memoir, and I hope you had a chance to read it ahead of time. It was posted online, but if not, maybe you'll read it afterwards. And I think what's special about this text is it's a personal reflection, and it offers us a way to think about the troubled times in the world that we're experiencing today and how we may respond. But it's also a kind of contemplation on the joy that arises from a life of renunciation, a life of simplicity, a life of living in the hut. So let me kind of dive in now. The text is written by a person named Kamo no Chome. Now, Kamo no Chome was born near Kyoto in around the year 1153. So really about half a century before Dogen Zenji was born. Now, Kamo no Chome means Chome of Kamo. And Kamo is the name of a river that flows through Kyoto. But it's also the name of a major Shinto shrine. And Chome's family had held a position of hereditary Shinto priest position for the Kamo shrine in Kyoto for many generations. But unfortunately, Chome's father died when Chome was still a young teenager, and the position was ultimately given to somebody else who was not in the family. Still, Chome prospered as a young man. When he was just 27 years old, he already had a reputation as a court poet, and some of his poems were published in the imperial anthology at the time, and that was a great, great honor. And yet, throughout his life, Chome was rather a social oddity. As a poet, he was respected by the elite and by the ruling class. But in all other areas of upper social life, he was considered an outsider, a person of lower class, because he wasn't born into the elite. He never married. And he never had any children that we know of. And Chome really struggled during that time that he was a court poet and involved in the court doing different positions. He struggled with the corruption that he saw, and he struggled with the shallowness that he saw in court life, particularly the kind of constant struggle to gain more status at almost any expense by the people who were living in the court. So at the age of 53, he renounced the world and he became a Buddhist monk. And then after 10 years as a Buddhist monk, he adopted the life of a hermit. And it was during this time, around the year 1212, that he wrote the Hojoki, or the Account of My Hut, that I'm going to be talking about from now on. During this time, it was a time of great chaos when Chome was alive. For 300 years before, the Japanese islands had been relatively peaceful, relatively stable. This period of time that lasted about 300 years is known as the Heian period. And it was a time of great cultural development, especially in the literary arts and the spread of Buddhism. Women were very prominent in writing beautiful diaries and some poetry, and the first novel, of course. And some historians call this the golden age of Japanese culture. And it was. But like everything, it shifted and changed. And by the year about 1100, the political system, which would be based on the emperor and the imperial court, was crumbling because provincial kind of warrior aristocrats, it's kind of a little bit hard to distinguish between the two, but essentially the provinces were rebellion. And they vied for control of the country. And about within 80 years later, civil war broke out between two major clans. I guess you couldn't call it civil war. It was like just simply war between two very powerful families that had arisen in the provinces, not within the capital itself. Anyway, this war left Japan devastated. And this short essay, this Hojoki, account of my hut, is in part a witnessing of successive natural and human-caused disasters that happened at the end of the Heian period that mark really a terrible time of social upheaval and death. The times were calamitous, with a fire that destroyed much of the capital, an earthquake that left countless homeless and dead, and then a great famine. Lawlessness was everywhere, as was deep poverty. The effects of all which were compounded by government indifference and ineptitude. So in some ways the Hojoki, this text, echoes the precarious nature maybe that we find ourselves in today. But this text is no mere rant or religious rant that heaps scorn on the world of woe. It is the record of one man's bearing witness to the troubles of his time and a record of his response. In Japan, this text is studied in high schools and is celebrated for its literary beauty and its philosophical depth. The translation that's posted is by Donald Keene, quite a noted scholar and translator of Japanese and Chinese culture. But there are several different translations of the Hojoki that you maybe find online or published in various places. A lot of scholars like to translate it. It's kind of like a lot of Chinese scholars like to translate the Tao Te Ching. Anyway, the Hojoki is a key part of the classical Japanese canon, and it's relatively easy to read. Maybe that's why it's so popular to translate. I like Keene's translation because I think he really captures the kind of straightforward and direct style of Chomei. Anyway, that's enough kind of background for the text. Let's have a look at a few passages and see what this text may offer us today. So this is the very opening lines or opening passages of the text. The flow of the river is ceaseless, and its water is never the same. The bubbles that float in the pools, now vanishing, now forming, are not of long duration. So in the world are man and his dwellings. It may be imagined that the houses, great and small, which vie roof against proud roof in the capital, remain unchanged from one generation to the next. But when we examine whether this is true, how few of the houses that were there of old. Some were burnt last year and only since rebuilt. Great houses have crumbled into hovels, and those who dwell in them have fallen no less. The city is the same. The people, as numerous as ever. But of those I used to know, a bare one or two in 20 remain. They die in the morning. They are born in the evening, like foam on the water. Whence does he come? Where does he go? Man that is born and dies. We know not. For those for whose benefit does he torment himself in building houses that last but a moment? For what reason is his eye delighted by them? This too we do not know. Which will be the first to go, the master or his dwelling? One may just as well ask this of the dew on the morning glory. The dew may fall and the flower remain only to be withered by the morning sun. The flower may fade before the dew evaporates. But though it does not evaporate, it waits not the evening. So that's the opening few lines. So Chomei begins his great essay with his major theme, of course, that of impermanence. Or in Japanese, mujō. We all understand that impermanence is, of course, a central Buddhist teaching, and our understanding of it is core to our practice. All that exists is impermanent. Everything changes. And we know the experience of impermanence can be exhilarating, or it can be terribly frightening. It can bring relief. Thank goodness that's over. Or it can bring despair. Where did that go? We all recognize the fact of impermanence, yet it is at times hard to really believe it and accept it with any equanimity. In the great Hindu epic, the Mahabharata, Yudhishthira, a wise leader, is asked, what is the greatest wonder in this world? It's an interesting question for each of us to answer, eh? What is the greatest wonder in this world? He replies, people see death all around them but do not believe they are going to die themselves. This is the greatest wonder. Even at the end of his life, the Buddha reinforced the teaching of impermanence with his last words to his followers. All conditioned things are impermanent. Strive on with diligence. For Chomei, impermanence was the inescapable and painful fact of life which led him eventually to become a hermit. And of course, impermanence is not unique to the Buddhist. It's not a uniquely Buddhist insight or unique to the Buddhist teachings. But the Buddhist response to impermanence, I think, is quite unique. It doesn't call for us to transcend impermanence, but for each of us to recognize the depth and completeness of impermanence and establish within ourselves an equanimity with the world as it is, and with our life as it is. In this opening section, Chomei points out to us that it's not only life that is impermanent, but of course all things, like our homes. These are all characterized by instability. Which will go first, the master or his dwelling? Chomei writes, nothing remains constant, so no matter how much one tries to keep change at bay, it's impossible, for this is the world of mujō. In the next few sections, Chomei shifts to describing in some detail the cataclysmic events that occurred in Kyoto around this time, the time that he was there. And as a side point, historians and scholars point out that Chomei's description left us really a very valuable record of that time, when most writers of that era were not interested in chronicling what happened to the masses. The great poet and very elite member of the imperial court, Fujiwara Teika, wrote this: "My ears are filled with news of uprising and killings. I care nothing about such matters." Chome, however, opened his eyes and he opened his heart to clearly witness the horrific events that he reported on. He bore witness to the suffering that surrounded him. And yet, I think with some humility, he didn't place himself at the center of it. You know, it's not my story about seeing all the suffering. It's just, this is what happened. And what he saw transformed his life. So let me read just a couple of more passages that illustrate this from each of the three main events that he saw. He wrote, "In the 40 and more years in the 40 and more years that have passed since I first became aware of the meaning of things, I have witnessed many terrible sights. It was, I believe, the 28th day of the fourth month of 1177. On a night when the wind blew fiercely without a moment of calm, that a fire broke out toward 9 o'clock in the southeast of the capital and spread northwest. It finally reached the gates and buildings of the palace, and within the space of a single night, all was reduced to ashes. The fire fanned out as the shifting wind spread it, first in one direction and then another. Houses far away from the fire were enveloped in smoke, while others nearby were simply in a sea of flame. Several thousand men and women lost their lives, as well as countless horses and oxen. Of all the follies of human endeavor, none is more pointless than expending treasures and spirit to build houses in so dangerous a place as the capital." And then he describes a great wind. "On the 29th day of the fourth moon of 1180, a great whirlwind sprang up in the northeast of the capital and violently raged as far south as the sixth ward. Every house, great or small, was destroyed within the area engulfed by the wind. Some were knocked completely flat. Others were left with their bare framework standing. Tops of the gates were blown off and dropped 400 or 500 yards away. And fences were swept down. Innumerable treasures from within the houses were tossed into the sky. A smoke-like dust rose, blindingly thick, and so deafening was the roar that the sound of voices were lost in it. Must be the blast of hell, I thought. Countless people were hurt and crippled." I'm a little bit kind of cutting out passages just so we can hit some of the, I think, some of the important points. But please read the whole thing when you get the chance. And then he talks about a famine. I'll pick it up here. "There was a famine in the country which lasted 2 years. A most terrible thing. A drought persisted through the spring and summer, while the autumn and winter brought storms and floods. One disaster followed another, and the grains failed to ripen. All in vain was the labor of tilling the soil in spring or planting in the summer, for there was none of the joy of the autumn reaping or winter harvest. Some of the people, as a result, abandoned their lands and crossed into other provinces. Some forgot their homes and went to live in the mountains. Overwhelmed by misery, they would walk in a stupor, only presently to collapse. The number of those who died of starvation outside the gates or along the roads may not be reckoned. There being no one even to dispose of the bodies, a stench filled the whole world. And there were many sights of decomposing bodies, too horrible to behold. Along the banks of the Kama River, there was not even room for horses or cattle to pass. Of all that has passed before my eyes, this famine was the strangest and saddest of all disasters. Now, reading this passage, you know, it brought back some of the images of New York with trailers, cooling trailers to hold the bodies. And of course, scenes from places of great devastation in the world today. And bearing witness, as Chomi does here, is more, of course, than just listening to the news. It is a commitment to see clearly both the world outside and the world within our own hearts. And Chomi uses all his senses to witness the great misery that occurs in the capital and through, although the suffering, I'm sure, for him was heartbreaking, he doesn't turn away. And he's not overwhelmed, and he's not bitter. And unlike other of his contemporaries, he understands the suffering he witnesses as also his own. Bearing witness in the Buddhist tradition is understood as a great act of compassion, requiring open hearts and a foundation for making wise decisions. Chomi eventually decided to withdraw from the court, realizing he was powerless to initiate changes there. I think it's clear from his writing that when we bear witness, we will sacrifice some of our own mental and emotional comfort. For in bearing witness, we partake in some small or great way of another's pain. As Chomi was well aware, the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara, or in Japanese, Kanon, is the embodiment of bearing witness. Her name can be translated as she who hears the cries of the world. The sutras that talk about Avalokiteshvara or Kanon portray her as always present to respond to all distress. And while there are many stories of her bringing aid, it is her willingness to listen that seems to bring the greatest comfort. It's no wonder that her ability to listen deeply marks her as the Bodhisattva of great compassion. When we make bearing witness a conscious part of our Buddhist practice, I think we give it context and meaning. Mindfully and compassionately opening ourselves to discomfort and distress, when we meet another suffering, we nurture compassion, and we strengthen our own ability to respond skillfully. During these times of our collective suffering with COVID-19 and racial violence and discrimination, I think our practice is to remain open, present, and as aware as possible. Because bearing witness will prepare the ground for courageously taking action when we see ways to prevent or alleviate suffering around us. Following Chomi's example, we can make effort to bear witness to our own troubling times. But this essay is not just about the great calamities of the end of the Heian period. It's also about our own individual suffering. So after writing about the calamities of Kyoto, Chome reminds the reader that distress and suffering arises not only in these great terrible events, but is woven into the continuum of everyday human life. It's just part of what we all experience. He writes this, "Those who are powerful are filled with greed, and those who have no protectors are despised. Possessions bring many worries. In poverty there is sorrow. He who complies with the ways of the world may be impoverished thereby. He who does not appears kind of deranged." Wherever one may live, whatever work one may do, is it possible even for a moment to find a haven for the body or peace for the mind? Well, this may strike us as overly pessimistic. But Chome is stressing the Buddhist teaching that we can't find contentment in things. We cannot keep what we find attractive, and we cannot avoid the unwanted. And he acknowledges that this struggle that we keep trying to do every day to hold on and to avoid is really just a painful way to live. How often do we find ourselves in confusion? How often do we find ourselves in kind of a dark and restricted place? Well, Chome's response to the suffering is to remove himself, ultimately to become a hermit. However, what he doesn't do is actually also, I think, a really important teaching for us. He doesn't lash out in anger. He doesn't talk about his hate or his bitterness over the situation. Although it's unspoken in the text, I think what comes forward is a spirit of quiet strength and dignity. He does not wallow in despair, but for the most part witnesses with clarity, understanding, and empathy. And then a shift happens. In the last half of this essay, we come to know Chome more as a person. We come to know him as a thoughtful, reflective, and imperfect monk. Chome, as I mentioned, was not a Zen priest. Zen was not really firmly established in Japan at this time. It was just starting. His main practices, as far as I know, were chanting Amida Buddha's name, a Pure Land practice, and reading the Lotus Sutra, a very important Buddhist text in Japan at that time and still today. Both were very popular at that time. In this part of the essay, we read that he retreats from the world into smaller and smaller abodes. And we see that human dwellings are a theme that he kind of constantly refers to. He writes this little interesting passage. "Of all the follies of human endeavor, none is more pointless than expending treasures and spirit to build houses in so dangerous a place as the capital. Not only were many houses damaged or destroyed by the winds, but countless people were hurt or crippled while repairing them. All is I have described it. The things in the world which make life difficult to endure, our own helplessness and undependability of our dwellings." Now, I kind of brought this forward because it seems these days of the pandemic, we're spending a lot of time in our homes, perhaps feeling their smallness, or maybe we're spending a lot of time fixing them up or tending to them in some way. Throughout this text, Chome points out how we use our homes for status, or symbols of wealth and power, and so we become attached to them. Certainly the wealthy did in Kyoto at that time. He also points out our precious homes, no matter how grand or magnificent, are all transient. Perhaps he's using our dwellings as a metaphor for our bodies or our egos. All things will dissipate with time. And if we deeply recognize this, then how shall we spend this life? Towards the end, Chome beautifully illustrates the transient nature of houses for us with a description of his very last abode, a small hut. He writes this, "I laid a foundation and a rough thatched roof. I fastened hinges to the joints of the beams, the easier to move elsewhere should anything displease me. What difficulty would there be in changing my dwelling? A bare two carts would suffice to carry off the whole house, and except for the carter's fee, there would be no expenses at all." So he builds his little hut that he can pack up and move rather than some grand house. He continues, "Since first I hid my traces here in the heart of Mount Hino." This is a little bit of a wild area, very close to Kyoto. "I have added a lean-to on the south and a porch of bamboo. On the west, I have built a shelf for holy water, and inside the hut, along the west wall, I have installed an image of Amida. Along the east wall, I have spread long fern fronds and mats of straw, which serve as my bed at night. I have cut open a window in the eastern wall, and beneath it have made a desk. Near my pillow is a square brazier, in which I burn brushwood. To the north of the hut, I have staked out a small plot of land, which I have enclosed with a rough fence and made into a garden. I grow many species of herbs there." Simple hut now is where he lives. Instead of battling impermanence and instability, Chome embraces it with this simple hut that can be easily dismantled and moved and rebuilt if it's necessary. Perhaps he saw his hut as a metaphor for birth and death and rebirth. Take it apart, put it back together later. It's clear, though, that he found freedom and contentment with his simple dwelling. Kind of like following a path of least resistance, right? Like an Aikido or Tai Chi practitioner. And so while it's true, Chome's life is one of renunciation, letting go of so many things to live the simple life. The simplicity is really an enabling renunciation. He writes, "Knowing myself and the world, I have no ambitions and do not mix in the world. I seek only tranquility. I rejoice in the absence of grief. Ever since I fled the world and became a priest, I have known neither hatred nor fear. I leave my span of days for heaven to determine, neither clinging to life nor begrudging its end. My body is like a drifting cloud. I ask for nothing. I want nothing. My greatest joy is a quiet nap. My only desire for this life is to see the beauty of the seasons." Now, Chome makes it very clear in the essay that he's not asking us to hold him up as some kind of model, that this is what we should do. He acknowledges he is just a human being struggling with his life and his times. just as we are. In the essay, he does question his retreat from the world, and he does question even his kind of warm attachment to the cobbled together little hut that he lives in. And yet, it's really clear that his renunciation brings joy and lightness to his life. So what is renunciation anyway? Suzuki Roshi said this, renunciation is not giving up the things of the world, but accepting that they go away. I think Chomei lived that in the end of his life. So here are some final words of Chomei describing himself. This is not from the Hojoki, but from another small text he wrote. So he wrote this. But human hearts are both strong and weak, both deep and shallow. When I consider my own heart, I see that it is not exempt from good, neither is it free from evil. Easily bent like grass before the wind, or hard to keep still, like the moon reflected on waves. Perhaps a beautiful description of all of us. So Kama no Chomei leaves us with two ways that we can bring forth during this time of being hermits. We can bear witness to our own suffering and the suffering that we see in this world, gently and compassionately, seeing it as clearly as we can, and responding when the place and time are appropriate. And I think, secondly, we can see what gifts our enforced renunciation brings us during this time. And we can rest in gratitude. And maybe we won't sell our homes and build little huts somewhere on the North Shore Mountains or someplace outside of Calgary on the foothills. But we can rest in gratitude. Rest in the beauty that is around us, as Chomei did, as he describes in other parts of the essay. Well, as I said, this text was a little different from the one we looked at yesterday. But I hope in our discussion of it, you found something of value, something that may help you a little bit during this time, as I did. So please, let us continue our wholehearted practice, bearing witness and great gratitude.
May our intention equally extend to every being and place.